Joe Rastafari.
My name is Kingsley Daly, better known as Akala. I'm a poet, rapper, and founder of the Hip Hop Shakespeare Company. I was born in London, and my dad and pretty much all of the elder men in my life were Rastas. Thanks to them, I grew up surrounded by Rastafarian culture, and this is my journey into discovering more about this cornerstone of my upbringing. Welcome to Roots, Reggae, and Rebellion.
By and large, people respect Rastafari as people who are resilient and tough.
I think Rastafari is an entrenched aspect of Jamaican culture now. So many of Rastafari values are now seen as mainstream Jamaican.
Rastafari was popularized through reggae music, and reggae music provided the basis for an alternative subculture of resistance.
Today, Rastafari is recognized as the cultural heartbeat of Jamaica, popularized around the world via reggae music. But in its early days, it was very much on the fringes of society, oppressed by both Jamaican and British authorities alike. Really, until Bob Marley and a whole host of other roots reggae stars made Rastafari internationally famous in the 1970s. What Rastafari provided was a sense of history and identity, a way to break free of colonial rule, and that's not just in Jamaica, it's a role it also played for many people here in Britain.
We're in a white man's society, right? We didn't ask to be born here, did we? We were born here and we've got to stick here.
Good evening. The spate of rioting in Britain's cities has been going on now every night for over a week. To understand the background to the violence, it is important to understand something of what young blacks in Britain think. People who were born here, but many of whom have retreated into a society of their own with different rules and different values.
England is a bit. England is a bit.
The 1960s and 70s in Britain were tough years for black people, whether you were born here or had emigrated over. Dub poet Linton Kwesi Johnson moved here in 1963 from Jamaica as a young boy.
I was 11 years old and I was very excited about going to England because England was the mother country. Well, they had all these unrealistic, childish expectations. Streets of London paved with gold. Everybody went around in horse-drawn carriages and all this kind of thing. So it was a rude awakening when I actually arrived on a gloomy November day and saw all these grey buildings polluted by smog and smoke. I thought, is this England? My God, what a disappointment.
England is a bitch. England is a bitch.
But it was more than just the gloomy environment that Caribbean immigrants had to deal with in the 60s and 70s, as did British-born black people. By the early 80s, as this BBC archive shows, racism in British inner cities was a serious problem.
As we were coming up the escalators coming from the tube, right, five CID just flew around us and tried to nick us. They said that we was nicking a lady's bag. Now, I just pulled out my wage packet and so did Kevin, and we just said, listen, we just come from work, you know what I mean? We're just coming up here to buy a couple of records and go home again. Now, them kind of things, they get to me, because I know I'm not a thief. It just kills you, you know what I mean? You know you haven't done anything, but yet still people are trying to pin something on you.
In a Ladbroke Grove leisure centre, I met up with some of my elders to talk about those days, about their experiences as young black men growing up in London, and about Rasta.
If you're on the street and some white guy attack you and you're fighting them, you always know as a black person, don't ever, ever go on the ground. Because you get a shock in your life that the ordinary people who is walking, you know, is putting the boot in. You can't understand why. Because remember, you're coming from the Caribbean. We don't know nothing about no racism. It's not the first time we see white people, but we never experience someone want to attack you because you're black. That's what sent a lot of us crazy.
Can you imagine an 8-year-old child, 1959, in a shop? They said go to the corner shop and buy bread. You walk in, you're so nervous, you know? And then suddenly you see a grown man look at you and say, you black bastard. And there's two women running the shop. They heard, and I thought they would say something. They just looked at me as if it didn't happen. And when I told my parents, they were like, don't worry about it. It's not a big thing. And it, over the years, you found that these things happen on a regular basis. Mm. And you stopped telling the parents because they couldn't do shit about it.
So in the 1970s, when artists like Vernon Spear, Max Romeo, the Mighty Diamonds, the Abyssinians, and of course Bob Marley arrived in Britain, they arrived in a society in the midst of racial turmoil. Their message of Rastafari and decolonization immediately connected with young black people in London and the rest of the UK. Here's dub poet Linton Kwesi Johnson again.
I could identify with this idea of an ancestral homeland. I could identify with the idea of a rejection of white European domination. Mm-hmm. And through reggae music, because reggae music provided the ethos of Rastafari, and I could identify with the lyricism of all the Rasta-influenced singers and players of instruments.
Can you give me a snapshot of what it was like in 70s London? What was the feeling in the streets for black youth, and where did Rastafari fit in the consciousness of black youth in that period?
It was a very tense period, you know. We were at war with the police. We didn't declare the war, they declared the war against us.
Middle-aged matrons and respectable working fathers, clerks and cooks and councillors, all have their own experiences.
So I get out of the car to see what's going on. The policeman pushed me. He said to me, get back in the car. They don't concern you. I said, but they concern me. I said, my friend.
Yeah.
Push me again. He said, no, get back in the car.
The innocent suffer with the guilty, and resistance can only make matters worse.
At the same time, my friend came in, and he punched me on the chin like that. And my friend said to him, why are you beating the guy? He hasn't done you anything. And he did the same to him.
My response to that was this poem, All We're Doing Is Defending, which is a poem of resistance.
Stand for the riot squad quick, because we're running wild. Bitter like bile, blood will guide their way. And I say, all we're doing is defending. So get you ready, the war, war.
It was tense. There was sus, there was harassment, there was intimidation, there was brutality. And reggae music provided the basis for an alternative subculture of resistance in the face of racial hostility. So it gave us an alternative identity. And we identified with the trappings of Rastafari, the colors red, gold, and green. We'd wear the woolen hats, any little artifacts that carry the Rastafari colors.
But of course, aligning yourself with Rastafari in the 60s and 70s came with its problems too. I asked my elders what it was like to be a Rasta in Britain back then.
You definitely know you're not going to get any employment. People used to say Rasta is dirty man.
But being a young Rastafarian, then first of all, I got kicked out of college.
What, because of?
I was going to Wilson College, really, still reading. No, it's a weird little crowd. Then the man said, when it comes to the lecture, said, take your hat off when you're in it. Do like the Englishman do. I said, I'm not an Englishman. So he said, leave. Well, I left.
Then
we had a lot of pressures. Sacrifice we had to make, man. We had the press attacking us. All these papers with the Rastafarians are criminal. The Rastafarians really smoke X amount of, you know, man smoke a lot, 100 pound of weed. The Rastafarians gonna take babies out of pram and kill them. That's what they said during the riots. National Front, jungle religion. All this kind of thing you had to put up with, man. It was hard.
I kind of understand that mythologies exist and are often more powerful than reality. And I think Rastafari's power is racial, spiritual, and mythological. On the one hand, it's clear that after a long period of indoctrination into a belief in a white Jesus, the need for a black image of God, a black image to replace this white image, especially when whiteness was a tool used to oppress people, that image was very powerful for people. It was very attractive to people.
And that seemed to be also the case in London. You know, if I look at why my father and so many others in the 70s were attracted to this belief system, I believe that the structural racism of British society, the legacies of colonialism and slavery, and the realities of being black in the world were certainly part of what made this image of an unconquered black emperor on the continent of Africa, the only kingdom in Africa to not be colonized, was so attractive to people, to the point that some people went as far as to say this man was God. After Bob Marley's death in May of 1981, Rastafari lost its talisman in reggae music, but its presence never went away, resurfacing through many big artists over the years like Capleton, Sizzla and Beanie Man. Outside of Jamaica, reggae music has helped Rastafari spread around the world, with some figures suggesting its global followers are now well in excess of 1 million. Of course, Rastafari has a big presence in Africa, but communities have also sprung up in places like New Zealand, Canada, and Japan. Alba Rosi is today a well-known reggae artist here in Jamaica. He's a white man from Sicily who has embraced Rastafari. He has long dreads, speaks in Jamaican patois, and follows the teachings of Haile Selassie. Back in Kingston, I caught up with him to find out how this deeply black spiritual movement found appeal with a white teenager growing up in Italy.
It happened like when I was like 13, 14, I was seeking answers. So I started questioning myself. So at first I took it as fashion. When you twist your ear and your friends them doing it, so you listen to reggae music. It was actually a challenge though, because it was a new something for me, different from my culture, the Italian Catholic Church, the Pope, the Vatican. So Rastafari was a different way to experience spirituality. At first, you don't really know much about it. You read about it. Then I start to meet people from Ethiopia. I start to talk to people and whatever, only to realize that Selassie himself was telling me not to believe in him, but believe in Jesus, because himself was a Christian. So I rediscover Christ through Selassie.
Alba Rosi now lives in Jamaica and is quite famous here. Rastafari seems to be incredibly adaptable. People seem to be able to take from it what they need. Whether you believe Haile Selassie was the reincarnation of Christ, whether you just see it as a political manifesto, or whether you're an Italian in need of spiritual nourishment. But if it's so easy to modify, does that mean there's a lack of substance in the original concept? I don't think so. I think one of Rastafari's strengths is that it doesn't have a central governing body. It doesn't have a central church that collects money and constructs massive buildings to overawe its followers. It doesn't seek political power in that way. It's very much an independent spiritual movement. But that's not to say that there aren't Rastafari followers who today have an economic base as they did in the 1930s. I travelled to one such camp on the outskirts of Kingston at Bobo Hill. Here lives a Bobo Shanti tribe of Rastas. I met up with some of their leaders to further understand how the Rastafari traditions work in the modern world.
The first procedure when you come is to pray, right?
Rastafari, repeat.
Jah,
Rastafari.
When they say Bobo Hill, really they should say Bobo Mountain, because it was a lot of effort to get up here. When we came in and we registered, one of the high priests here held a prayer for us. We had to face to the east and hold the Trinity with our palms, which is sort of like making a triangle by clasping your index fingers and your thumbs together, and give thanks, as they say, which is to give thank yous to Jah Rastafari. We're in the settlement now, and it's like a fort. You can see there's some small settlements and camps and houses. There's a school here called the Jerusalem Schoolroom. I presume this is like an outdoor school. We've just registered in the embassy, which is entitled the Black Sovereign Nation Ethiopian Embassy, Egypt in Jamaica, 10 miles from Bull Bay, St. Andrews. So right there, so you have a little piece of Africa right here in Jamaica conceptually.
Yeah, man, go and pump it.
Well, my name is Prophet Marvin still, you know.
What would you describe the Baba Shanti order as?
Alright, this order now is a righteous order. You know, see it, and we are the people of the true Israelite.
Mm. You personally, how long have you been in this particular place?
Alright, yeah, naturally, and I the year from 88.
From 88?
Yeah, man, from 88, and I come here, you know. Mm. Yeah, man, you know, see it, come to the father. From
the brother we were just talking to, Marvin, came here as he was a youngster growing up. At school, he used to come here after school because the truck from here used to go and collect water. These times, there wasn't running water up here. And he would come here and started to learn about the teachings of Rastafari. And eventually, at 14, he decided he wanted to come and live here. And he went and told his parents. His father particularly was none too happy. And his father threw a lot of big stones at him. He came back up here for 3 months. And after 3 months, his father had calmed down when he went back to see him. His father was like, you know what, you're doing the right thing. And was accepting of his conversion, I suppose, to Rastafari. Veganism, or Aitau food, has long been a tradition in Rastafari, and it's a tradition that is continued today at Boba Hill. Professor Carolyn Cooper is head of literary and cultural studies at the University of the West Indies.
Always in Rastafari that the body is a temple of the living God. And so Rastafari always had this sense that food is important. You know, we now had a whole food revolution where people going towards organic food, but Rasta were organic from the beginning.
From long.
And so even the refusal to use salt, you know, to have Aitau food was really food that didn't have a lot of salt or actually had no salt at all. It was really about thinking creatively about what food does to the body. And that Rasta attitude to food has spread throughout the societies.
This is another side of the foundation, you know?
So essentially it's a small brewery. Yeah. There's large barrels that have... What's inside the barrels?
Roots.
So inside the barrels are different roots and herbs.
Yeah.
And you might boil up...
Pomegranate.
Right. And this is where they're stored?
Yeah.
And then you boil them and ferment them?
Yeah, in the barrel.
Right, and then make the roots drinks. This one aids digestion, strengthens nerves, purifies blood, reduces cholesterol, and cleanses body. Where do you sell them? Do you sell the roots down in Kingston? Or
yeah, Kingston, all over. Yeah, man, we ship them all overseas too.
Talking with the rootsmen, it soon became apparent that as well as having economic independence, repatriation to Africa was still very much central to their agenda.
You need to go home back to Africa right now, you know?
You physically need to go home back to Africa, or are you establishing Africa in Jamaica?
No, physically need to go home to Africa.
It was fascinating to discover from the rootsmen at Bobo Hill that they still physically wanted to return to Africa. Rastafari has long followed Marcus Garvey's philosophy of repatriation, which in and of itself came out of a longer tradition which included the foundings of Liberia and Sierra Leone. Even today, there is a large repatriated Rastafarian community at Shashamani in Ethiopia, founded on land given to them by Haile Selassie himself. Here at Baba Hill, I met an elder Rasta woman who told the same story.
Rastafari is the truth of life. And we are about freedom, redemption, and international repatriation. We want to go home to Africa. Africa is our birthright. And we really want Queen Elizabeth, because she is the author of us being here. And we are asking her to send ships to take us back to Africa. We want to go home, because we've been waiting for it a long time. Got to go home, got to leave this land, got to find myself somewhere where milk and money flow.
There's a long history of repatriation in relation to the founders of Liberia and Sierra Leone, in terms of Africans going back to Africa from Brazil. You know, it's natural that if you don't choose to emigrate from your place of birth, if you're kidnapped and enslaved and have your identity taken away, that you would have this longing for this home. And so that seems like a natural desire to me, and it continues throughout America and the African diaspora, and even in the UK, there's a constant conversation about what is home for black people. And this is one of the legacies of transatlantic slavery and colonialism. And so one manifestation of that is this demand that we've just heard, that others who profited massively repatriate these people.
Rastafari never.
never leave I alone. So even when the road get rocky, me say me never give up. I said
today, as well as through camps like Bobo Hill, Rastafari lives on through a new wave of Rasta artists who have taken Jamaica by storm. Dread singers like Jesse Royal, Taurus Riley, Janine, and Chronix.
No, Rastafari guide Janine from the beginning. Oh, oh, oh.
Here's poet and Mali biographer Kwame Dawes.
I think right now what is really exciting is there's a new group of young Rastafarian musicians and singers who are writing really interesting work. People like Chronix and Nature, and these guys are really interesting because they are a throwback to the sort of roots era, but they have a kind of savvy understanding of the present moment and also connecting back to the past history.
These are the children who have grown up in the movement.
Arlene McKenzie from the Rastafari Indigenous Village in Montego Bay.
The ones I know are children who have not just come on board at a later stage. Mm. These are children who have grown up in the
whose
movement.
Parents were Rastafari.
Yes, and who have seen that it works.
Mm-hmm.
And they are carrying the message forward. That's mm-hmm. the resurgence. And their voices are being heard.
The music is modern, there are electronic beats, synthesizers and computer-made backing tracks, but the message remains the same. It looks like Rastafari is in rude health and continues to live on in the rest of the world. The new generation of Rasta artists command huge, global fan bases. It's a reminder that in pure financial terms, Rastafari has been massively beneficial to Jamaica through music and tourism. Dr. Kadamwe Naif is a lecturer in strategic planning and social entrepreneurship at the University of the West Indies.
How has Rastafari has influenced Jamaica in terms of how money is generated? The creative industries. If we examine what is defined as a creative industry, you find that lived Rastafari synchronizes well with those things. The music, the food, the culture. That Jamaican-ness, what I refer to as Rastafari, as what has provided a lot of those goods and services. Even the ganja industry, man, whether it be legal or illegal. Medical marijuana is currently projected at $1 billion US, and it's projected to be about $6 billion over the next 2 years. That is in America. Now, what is the recreational use industry? $40 billion. Life is only in smoking ganja. I know Rastafari influence people in using ganja as a plant.
Marijuana in my soul. Marijuana in my heart.
I haven't researched Dr. Nash's figures, but I think most of us can accept a lot of people smoke weed. Rastas use the herb as a religious sacrament. It's been part of their tradition for many years, and since the 1930s, they've consistently sung its praises for its medicinal uses, long before there was any apparently scientific research into the subject. Today, as Dr. Knife suggests, it looks like the rest of the world is beginning to agree with the Rastas. After many years of declaring a war on weed, America has decriminalized marijuana in several states. Jamaica looks set to follow suit later in the year. There's a lot of money at stake, but will Rastafari reap any of the benefits?
I love to smoke marijuana.
Rastafarian, Arlene McKenzie.
Our industry was totally eradicated. Our people were totally punished and beaten and incarcerated for this thing that is now going to be the new panacea for health, wealth, and prosperity. And yet we are now behind, way behind with that. Rastafari, who pioneered the growing and using and cultivating and research, we're totally out of the picture for this. This thing is so illegal, yet still in America, which is right next to us right here, is now the legal thing. And it's grown in California and everybody can label it and all the different brands and names. And what do we have here? We have been stripped of our heritage.
Cool, oh cool, cool Rasta, cool.
But slowly and surely, Rastafari's global presence has been cemented. For me, as someone who grew up with this culture, I've always known that this very black movement has provided an important sense of identity and purpose well beyond Jamaica and its diaspora. But through making this documentary series, I've also realized how vital Rastafari has been as part of healing the psychological scars of transatlantic slavery and colonialism. Here's Professor Carolyn Cooper, Head of Cultural Studies at the University of the West Indies.
So many of Rastafari values are now seen as mainstream Jamaican. So the language, the food, the whole approach to the sense of self, Rastafari is now a part of Jamaica. It's not as it was in the old days where Rasta were seen as these fringe lunatics. More and more people have come to see that, you know, they were sensible. They knew what they were doing. They were talking about how we should be in a post-colonial society.
For nearly 80 years, Rastafari has been at the heart of resistance to oppression. To think that the damage caused by centuries of brutality can be undone in 50 or so years of independence is, frankly, ridiculous. But Rastafari, through reggae music, has spread its message and helped those of the African diaspora to reinvent themselves while simultaneously reminding them of their history, traditions, and identity. It has also leapt beyond this community and had an impact globally.